Blog Talk Radio.
I dreamed out one evening by a river of discontent. A bus ran into old Tom Payne, was running down the road he went. Said, I can't start right now, child. King George is after me. He'd have a rope around my throat and hang me on the Liberty Tree. And I will dance to Tom Payne's waltz. I'll dance to Tom Payne's waltz. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. Well, I only talked about freedom, justice for everyone. Like since the penny first when I spoke, I've been looking down the barrel of a gun. And they say I preach revolution. Let me say in my defense that all I did wherever I went was to talk a lot of common sense. And I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. I will dance Tom Payne's bones. Dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. Well, old Tom Payne, he ran so fast, he left me standing still. And then I was a piece of paper in my hand, standing at the top of the hill. And it said, this is the age of reason. These are the rights of man. Kick off religion and monarchy. It was written in Tom Payne's sand. And I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. Well, dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. Well, old Tom Payne, then he lies. Nobody laughs, nobody cries. Where he's gone or how he fears, nobody knows, nobody cares. But I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. I'll dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own, to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own to the rhythm of Tom Payne's bones. I will dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance to Tom Payne's bones. Dance in the oldest boots I own.
Radio.
I'm going to Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think,
Radio Free Kansas,
that's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh man, that is just wrong.
world. If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
Even on BBC as I speak right now. It went all over the place, really. Yes, poor Mitt Romney. Well, I guess speaking as the 47%. Isn't that the number? 47%. Yes, that broke all over the place. It opened up, you know, for me, I found out about it. I was sort of goofing off this morning. Every morning, I make breakfast for my son before he takes off on the school bus. And we watch the news. We are fortunate enough on air, over the air, in the morning, beginning at KQWU, Washburn University, PPS affiliate. We get to watch Al Jazeera in the morning, France 24, BBC, and then we usually get bored after the news from Vietnam comes, or Singapore, or Hong Kong. Those are just propaganda outlets. But we go to CBS Morning News with Charlie Rose now. So they really made sort of a breakout of morning news, trying to. They're not doing very good, if you ask me, but it beats what the other networks are doing with Good Morning America. So we check out Charlie Rose on CBS Morning News, and there it is. Lead story this morning. Right there, it felt good to see Mother Jones' video being aired with Mitt Romney secretly being filmed at a fundraiser at Boca Raton before a crowd of millionaires saying some really honest. I think it's honest the way the millionaire class and the billionaires think. I do. I think that's the honest. You were seeing honest. And later on in the day, as it settled in about the 47%, I turned on Rush Limbaugh. I do that every once in a while. I think something's going to happen. When something. The idiot, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the idiot has to say from his golden microphone with EBI or whatever it is, Excellence in Broadcasting for the Billionaires. So I wanted to see what this multimillionaire had to say, Rush Limbaugh, about the Mother Jones video. And it was very interesting. He went on and on. And he was blown. What? He was livid. He was mad. He was yelling. He was screaming. He was rustling his paper. You know how that goes here. I'm mad. I can't stand it. Don't the 47%. We need to go to the 47% and tell them that we love them, that we can make it better for them. They must. They need to know this is a golden opportunity for them. To vote for Mitt Romney, of course. Well, it's It went on for on, and I've actually made some cuts. I'm not going to play them tonight because we've got real news to do tonight. But needless to say, it's just been going on and on. I haven't checked out the other Glenn Becks and all them nuts. I mean, of course, I'm sure Glenn Beck's going nuts, you know. But just based on the longevity, I don't know if this is going to last. Limbaugh speculates conspiracy theories, says Jimmy Carter's grandson gathered it, that he found it on YouTube, and then Limbaugh, he goes, why did they wait? They could have had, they've had this since May. Why did they wait? Is this a September surprise? He turns it into like a diabolical conspiracy or something. Were they going to release this in October, but they had to do it now? Who is they? I always listen to these flying saucer type people. I when they start talking they, when they use that pronoun, I guess it's a pronoun, they, I begin to think, you know, who is they? Well, I doubt seriously that Obama, his advisors, or anybody, even in the, for that matter, in the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, or even the Democratic National Committee, I don't think any of them, they might have got a heads up from Mojo maybe a few days before. You know, what is interesting is following Mojo, Mother Jones, because here's what the real scoop is, brothers and sisters. Never mind what the mainstream media is doing. Never even mind what Obama's doing. Never even mind what the DNC is doing. Never even mind what the DSLC, anything with D or R in it. Forget all that. Just forget it. Go to the source that got the tape. I'm sure many of you are. Many of you are very active. Go to the source that has the tapes and watch the whole thing. Very interesting. Why the mainstream media, Charlie Rose, for instance, on CBS Morning News, as I was telling you earlier, reported only one very short clip, the disparaging remarks he made about just a little bit less than half of all of us in this country, that we're all moochers, basically. My mother getting a pension check for working 20 years with the federal government, that makes her a moocher, you know. Or the people who don't pay taxes. And strangely enough, the Atlantic, I've been following this. Atlantic Monthly website has an article. I haven't got the name of the reporter yet, and the Tax Foundation put a map on, and the map is going everywhere, that 10 of the lowest paying filers, the lowest number of people who pay tax, the highest number of people who do not pay taxes in certain states, there's a map. And ironically, Mitt Romney is making the most disparaging remarks about the moochers and the people who don't pay taxes, federal income tax, are in the GOP red states of the South. And by the way, Kansas isn't far off from that. Not just geographically, but there is this interesting twist, this whole thing, that the people who pay the least amount of taxes, the top 10, are all right there in the red state areas, going from Florida all the way to Texas across the South. I find that extremely interesting. And I'm going to write up a piece about it. I'll make sure you try to get it. If you don't, if you want to get on, I send out very irregularly. I don't bomb your mailbox. You might get one a week saying who's going to be on. By the way, Chuck Thompson, who is going to be on this Saturday at high noon Central on RFK, and his book, Better Off Without Them. And I think he's talking about these very same 10 states along the South. A Northerner's Manifesto for Southern Secession. We're going to have a lot of profane and profound fun Saturday. I can't emphasize enough. And he is going to show up. He's not going to blow me off. I even have his cell number. In any event, he will be on And then 3 days later, he'll be in Kansas City at the Kansas City Library to talk about the very same subject. So it's just going to be, it's just perfect timing. Don't ask me. I need to, you know, I don't know, up my subscription to Mother Jones Magazine for this. Tell you for sure. Mother Jones came through and really got the goods on just how callous these people are. But I got off a tangent there, I'm sorry. But, you know, really, watch the whole video, all the videos, you know, because it really is a inside look into how these schmucks think of us. Not just the 47%, but really the 99% of us. So, take it or leave it, man. Well, on with Radio Free Kansas tonight. We have a great lineup. It's This Way Out Tuesday. And we'll start off with Free Speech Radio News headlines and then go right into This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Magazine, radio magazine. And then Amanda Marcotte's Outstanding from Reproductive Health RH Reality Check. We'll have her in the lineup. Then we'll have the complete Free Speech Radio News program. I will try not to take up too many break times. I'll just get right through the program since I'm taking up a little bit of time here at the beginning. I want to let you know I appreciate your downloads. The downloads are important. And don't forget, you can listen to it. You're going to need earbuds or, you know, headphones. Safe for work on your cell phone. There is a Blog Talk Radio app. I don't know how to use it, but it's possible to get my program automatically. And many of you are doing it from the numbers I'm saying. Spread it around. Tell your relatives. Have fun. On to Free Speech Headlines, Free Speech Radio News Headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen confirmed today that the U.S.-led international force in Afghanistan will scale back on-the-ground partner patrols with local forces. Some say such partnerships have reduced the number of civilian casualties in Afghanistan. The move was originally revealed Sunday and attributed to a recent uptick of attacks against NATO forces by Afghan security known as green-on-blue attacks. Rasmussen said today that the change in strategy will not affect the end date for troop withdrawal.
The overall strategy, it remains the same, that we will continue to hand over in a gradual process lead responsibility for the security to the Afghan security forces, and that process will be completed by the end of 2014, and our ISAF combat mission will end by the end of 2014. Nothing has changed.
Officials also hope the move will minimize risk to foreign forces as protests against a film that ridicules Islam and the Prophet Muhammad continue across the region and around the world. In Bangkok today, hundreds protested outside the U.S. Embassy, which closed hours before, and Indian-administered Kashmir came to a standstill before protests turned violent in the summer capital, Srinagar. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
The shutdown against the anti-Islam film evoked a near-total response in most parts of the Muslim-dominated Kashmir Valley. Shops and businesses were shut, and transport was off the roads. Protesters gathered at many places in the capital Srinagar and in other towns as well. They chanted anti-US and anti-Israel slogans and burned US flags and effigies of Barack Obama. A protest march turned violent near the central city when protesters set fire to a government vehicle parked outside the residence of Deputy Chief Minister Tara Chand. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd, who hurled stones in return. Protests against the film have been held in the region since Friday. Calling the film a conspiracy of the West, they want punishment for the filmmaker. A police spokesperson said that except for the vehicle burning incident, most protests around the region today remained peaceful. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
This evening in Fullerton, California, the city's acting police chief is expected to tell the city council that Kelly Thomas, a mentally disabled homeless man, did absolutely nothing to provoke the police beating that led to his death. Lena Nazizwe has more.
On July 5th of last year, officers responded to a call that someone was vandalizing cars. Police questioned Thomas and later reported that he resisted arrest, but surveillance video shows nothing of the kind. Rather, it reveals an unprovoked, brutal beating by six police officers, at the end which Thomas is crying out for his daddy. He died 5 days later. Fullerton Mayor Pro Tem Bruce Whitaker says tonight's statement is almost unprecedented.
It could certainly have gravity in the case, in both the criminal case and the civil case that Mr. Thomas has brought against the city, because it could be considered an admission that the officers weren't acting within full scope of their authority.
So far, two officers have been charged in the killing. One is still under investigation, and three city council members have been recalled. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Thousands of platinum miners in South Africa will go back to work on Thursday after agreeing to a 22% pay raise. The strike at the UK-based Lonmin mine outside of Johannesburg lasted 5 weeks. 34 strikers died when police tried to squelch the protest. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court sent the state's voter ID law back to a lower court today. The state's high court ordered another look at the availability of alternate ID cards to make sure that voters have free and easy access to non-driver's license identification. But State Department of Transportation officials readily admit they still require rigorous documentation. Today's ruling doesn't overturn the voter ID law, but does order the lower courts to suspend the law if voters don't have liberal access to ID or if disenfranchisement will occur. And Chicago teachers are still on the picket line today. Union officials are meeting this afternoon to review a proposed contract and consider calling off the strike. If they don't, tomorrow morning a judge will hear Mayor Rahm Emanuel's request to order them back to work. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
The evolution of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights has advanced through the platform of the Democratic Party over the last 20 years has been extraordinary. We went from early calls just for anti-discrimination to adding in recognition of relationships to a platform that this year calls for full and complete equality.
My bill is incredibly simple. All it does is insert a definition and say that marriage is between two people, regardless of their sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Pro-gay Kampala play performances put their British producer in prison, U.S. Democrats plank down their best ever pro-gay platform, and a Labour lesbian leads New Zealand's move to marriage equality. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Jason Proctor.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 15, 2012. The British producer of a gay-affirming play staged in Uganda was thrown in jail this week. David Cecil has been charged with disobeying lawful orders contrary to the penal code and for defying a ban by Uganda's media authorities against any production of The River and the Mountain. The play, written by British playwright Bo Hopkins, but directed and performed by Ugandans, examines the challenges faced by a young gay businessman in the East African country and questions the motives of Uganda's strident anti-gay lobby. It was performed at several smaller venues around the capital city of Kampala after initial plans to debut the play at the National Theatre of Uganda were quashed by government officials. An edict against any performance of the play was issued by the Uganda Media Council, which demanded to review the script first. Simon Lokoto, Uganda's Ethics and Integrity Minister, told Britain's Guardian newspaper that this play is justifying the promotion of homosexuality in Uganda, and Uganda does not accommodate homosexual causes. But Claire Bayarugaba, a spokeswoman for the Ugandan Civil Society Coalition on Human Rights and Constitutional Law, an LGBT advocacy group, told Agence France-Presse that such acts go against the constitutional provisions of freedom of expression and assembly, adding that these charges only serve to propel further the state of Uganda's anti-gay campaigns. Private consensual adult gay sex is already a crime in Uganda, but proposed legislation infamously known around the world as the Kill the Gays Bill, sponsored by a member of parliament with strong ties to right-wing Christian groups in the U.S., includes the death penalty for aggravated homosexuality. Any public discussion of LGBT people, including rights advocacy, would also be punished by up to 7 years behind bars. At last report, the bill remains stalled in a parliamentary committee. Cecil could spend 2 years in prison if he's found guilty of violating the Uganda Media Council's directive. His lawyer said the British producer was not released on bail because the magistrate first demanded that Cecil turn over his passport. But police officials confiscated it during the arrest, and they refused to release it.
A state-sponsored newspaper in Iran claims to have uncovered a secret plot by Jewish financial and human capital, along with the West, particularly America and Britain, to spread homosexuality around the world. According to the Huffington Post, the supposed exposé was entitled Introduction to the Overt and Covert Aspects of Spreading Homosexuality in the World. In addition to the claims of a global conspiracy, the newspaper also attacked progressive Jews in Israel for supporting such actions. The report cautions that abomination and a moral phenomenon would become commonplace and used to subjugate those who did not accept homosexuality. These people need care and medical treatment to rescue them from the immoral actions that undermine the family institution. The Iranian newspaper also blamed the U.S. film industry and Jewish universities for the problem because they teach homosexuality. An article about the Iranian report in the Jerusalem Post concludes that it legitimizes the execution of gays in Iran. They made a text not only to ridicule the West, but to provide a reason why Iran executes gays.
Does your son have a muscular body and like to show it by wearing V-neck and sleeveless clothes? Does your daughter like to hang out, have meals, and sleep in the company of women? Those are among the telltale signs that you may have a gay or lesbian child, at least according to the Teachers Foundation of Malaysia. With the support of the country's Department of Education, they've organized seminars claiming to help educators and parents spot signs of homosexuality in children. 10 such seminars have already been held across the Southeast Asian nation, the most recent, hosted this week by Deputy Education Minister Puad Zarkashi, drew about 1,500 people. The country's increasingly conservative federal government said in March that it's working to curb the problem of homosexuality, especially among Muslims, who make up over 60% of Malaysia's 29 million people. Despite widespread criticism, a camp for boys identified as effeminate was set up last year on the East Coast to teach them how to become men. Same-gender sex is a crime against the order of nature in Malaysia. Offenders can be punished with up to 20 years in prison, along with fines and caning. Malaysian LGBT activist Pankit Teak told the independent Malaysia Today website that the Ministry of Education is now officially a bully. I never presumed to be in the position to teach the meaning of education to people running the Ministry of Education, but it has come to that.
Meanwhile, the adult cosmetology program at the Beaumont Independent School District's Taylor Career and Technology Center in Southeast Texas was canceled by its principal this week because he thought one of the new students was gay. Instructor Sequeda Clark told the local Examiner newspaper that Principal Thomas Amons said at an event in April that he didn't want to see flamboyantly gay guys in his school. "I couldn't believe it then," Clark said. "I kind of thought he was just venting at that time." But Amons pulled the plug on the program after he briefly met new 22-year-old student Kwamani Gray during the first day of class this week. Clark said that Amons, who also serves as a deacon at Antioch Missionary Baptist Church, told her to tell Gray that he wasn't welcome, but she refused. She told the Examiner that she only came forward after the decision to end the program because she had to stand up for what's right. Aside from her teaching job, Clark is a church pastor and the owner of a salon in Beaumont. She told the newspaper that she was subsequently fired by the school district, which didn't surprise her, but she lamented the end of a program that she said had been used most often by single mothers who were trying to start a career. The district's legal counsel reportedly told Amons that he couldn't prevent anyone from enrolling, but that he did have the power to cancel the program entirely. It had been offered for more than a decade. Gray told the Examiner that he is gay, but that he'd never been open about it until now. He said he was forced into the spotlight after the entire class was told that the cosmetology program was being canceled because of him. He spent the last 3 years at Lamar University and wanted to enter the program to save money and earn his cosmetology license before finishing college to become a nurse. "This is like a hate crime," Gray said. "Amons never even talked to me. He just judged me."
In other U.S. news, more than 15 Friend of the Court briefs were filed late last week in support of a lesbian widow who's challenging the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. The 1996 law bars the federal government from recognizing the legal marriages of same-gender couples. The supportive paperwork came from the State Attorneys General of New York, Connecticut, and Vermont, 145 Democratic members of the U.S. House of Representatives, the City of New York, the Partnership for New York City, a major business lobby, the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and labor, legal, and religious organizations. Now 83 years old and in failing health, Edie Windsor legally married Thea Speier in Canada in 2007, a marriage that was recognized by their home state of New York. When Speier died in 2009 after a long battle with multiple sclerosis, Windsor, who was her caregiver for many years, was forced to pay more than $360,000 in estate taxes because the federal government did not recognize their marriage. As Windsor recently told The Advocate, "If Thea had been Theo, I would have had to pay no estate tax whatsoever." A federal judge hearing her case in New York ruled in June that DOMA is unconstitutional. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives took up the defense of the law after the Obama administration declined to defend it last year. They've appealed that ruling to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Federal courts in California and Connecticut have also found the law to be unconstitutional. The First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston became the first federal appellate court to rule DOMA unconstitutional this past May in a challenge from the state of Massachusetts. That case has been appealed to the Supreme Court. Attorneys for Windsor have asked the High Court to hear her case on an expedited basis, citing her advanced age and fragile health. The U.S. Department of Justice this week filed briefs in support of that request and also asked the court to expedite another case challenging DOMA's constitutionality.
And finally, reports have surfaced that homophobic Pope Benedict XVI was tricked into appearing with two porn actors who were dressed as priests while filming a new Bellamy gay adult movie in Vatican City. According to the Gay Star News, Scandal in the Vatican is the story of a couple of young priests who enjoy their sex experiences in the heart of Italy's capital, Rome. And viewers will see Pope Benedict XVI blessing the main actors in a Vatican meeting. According to Bellamy producer George DeRoy, the scene will be the film's most interesting part. Several comments on the Advocate website essentially had the same punchline about the porn actors and the Pope. They were probably too old for him anyway.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 15th, 2012. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep This Way Out on the air at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Jason Proctor.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
So, you don't want to miss a week of This Way Out's global news reports, being introduced to terrific new music by openly LGBT artists, hearing about a new hit movie even before the buzz begins. The answer is a subscription to This Way Out. You can have our programs on CD delivered right into your mailbox, and for much less than the cost of a newspaper subscription. For easy how-to information, just log on to thiswayout.org or email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us for more information at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA.
We'll go to New Zealand to hear the echoes of what's become a global discussion of marriage equality. But first, the Democratic National Convention earlier this month yielded more than pretty speeches on behalf of LGBT rights. The party's platform included its strongest stance yet on key policy issues. But that platform will need more than pretty words to bring real results. Co-anchoring Pacifica Radio's coverage of the convention, KPFA's Davey D spoke with two California party activists, including This Way Out's own Rick Watts.
At the Democratic National Convention here in Charlotte, we want to turn our attention to some of the things that are on the platform, and we have a couple of people here. One of them is considered a kingmaker, and he even has the name to fit it. His name is Eric C. Bauman, and he's the chair of the Los Angeles County Democratic Party. We also have here from West Hollywood, Rick Watts, and they're both in the building. And Mr. Bauman, let me start off with you. In terms of platform, one of the big issues that has dominated discussion all year has been around the rights of LGBT, in particular marriage equality. What can you tell us about that with respect to the platform?
Well, the simplest thing to say is that the evolution of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights has advanced through the platform of the Democratic Party over the last 20 years has been extraordinary. And we went from early calls just for anti-discrimination to adding in recognition of relationships to a platform that this year calls for full and complete equality of marriage for all people, so that everyone has the opportunity and the right to marry the person that they love, and not to be caught up in the argument about marriage in name only, marriage not in name, same benefits. It's nonsense. All Americans pay equal taxes. All Americans should have the right to be married equally.
When we have these discussions, people in the religious community seem to object, and we saw a little tension going on. How did that get massaged, especially in a party as diverse as this, around marriage equality? What did it take to massage that through?
Well, the simple and most important piece of this is that no faith-based organization, no church, is obligated to perform or sanctify any marriage that doesn't fit their particular rules, regulations, and biblical authority. So if you are a church or a synagogue or a mosque who strictly adheres to Levitical law, you're not obligated to marry people of the same sex if that's not what your organization allows. And that was the thing that enabled us to get all folks on board, because it's very clear language that exempts churches from having to perform any ceremonies they choose
right.
not to. And by the way, let's be clear. We're talking about marriage in the civil law context. Marriage in America, under our Constitution and under our laws, is a civil contract between people that creates a set of rights, responsibilities, and obligations
right.
between two people and between the state and federal governments and those individuals
right.
and their heirs. So that's the part of marriage we're talking about, not whether or not a rabbi, a priest, or an imam blesses your wedding.
Right. Those are two separate things.
Correct.
Makes sense. Rick, what would you add to that?
Yes, thank you. By the way, I hasten to add, Eric is not only chair of the Los Angeles Democratic Party, but is vice chair of the California Democratic Party.
Okay.
The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which is still before Congress all these years later, is necessary to get through Congress in order to ban discrimination in housing and employment, rather, throughout the United States, because it's still legal to discriminate in most states on the basis of sexual orientation, no matter how good a job someone does. I hasten to add, by the way, that it is thanks to the Democratic Party that the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell law was repealed. It would not have happened without this party.
Right.
Well, let me just qualify. It would not have happened without this president, because this really took heavy lifting by President Obama to get through, and that's very important. Because
let me ask you this, Eric or Rick. What other things do you want to see added to the party platform that might not have gotten on if you had your wish list? What do you think will be coming down the pipe? Or what should our listeners know that might excite them that is actually on there that might not have been as publicized?
Well, from my vantage point, I think this platform really has made and met most of the desires of most Democrats and most progressives. Now, look, we want a world without war. We want a world that supports people, that gives people an opportunity, that gives people a hand up. And while this platform reflects much of that, what our energy has to really be directed at now is moving it from language into platform, which is the philosophic statement of our party, into actually getting it into law. And in order to do that, we've got to be able to get Democratic majorities in the United States Senate. We've got to keep the majority that we have and return to a majority in the House of Representatives. So long as there's a Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, it doesn't matter how much we talk about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and whether or not it's transgender inclusive, we're not going to get it on the floor for a vote because the Republicans will never let it out. And that's what we have to do in order to make these things become law.
Okay, Rick.
Yeah, I'd hasten to add also that with respect to matters of faith, that there are an awful lot of persons of faith who fully support equality for,
absolutely.
For LGBT persons,
right.
And I'm one of them. And by the way, I might add, a former Republican.
That's why I'm a little bit nervous sitting next to him. Yeah. I'm not sure how pure he is.
This is a big accomplishment to get LGBT rights onto the platform and move it beyond just being a philosophical statement, but to really challenge it and try to find ways to make it into law. It's a big step. Eric Bowman, Ricky Watt, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us on here. I love being on the show, and I love your accent. It makes me feel like I'm at home.
There you go.
Davey D was one of the anchors of Pacifica Radio's coverage of the Democratic National Convention.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
When the New Zealand Parliament approved a marriage equality bill in the first of three votes earlier this month, MP Louisa Wall credited U.S. President Barack Obama's pronouncement on the issue for boosting the legislation. That was a modest pronouncement on her part, since many would give the outspoken Labour lesbian herself a large share of the credit. In Auckland, This Way Out correspondent Ross Stevenson sat down with Wall to get the inside story.
Welcome, Louisa. Let's set the scene for our international listeners. New Zealand's marriage laws don't presently specify the gender of the persons wishing to marry, so why do we need this change?
We need this change because currently our laws don't allow same-sex couples to marry. Just a quick history of homosexual law reform in New Zealand. So in 1986, New Zealand decriminalised homosexuality, so we call it homosexual law reform legislation. In 1993, we then added under our Human Rights Act, Section 21, the fact that you couldn't discriminate against a New Zealander based on their sexual orientation. In 1995, so 10 years post homosexual law reform, we had three lesbian couples who went to their local registrar. They wanted to get married. They were denied that right. They went to the Court of Appeal ultimately. And also, Jules Jocelyn and her partner Jenny Rowan took New Zealand to the United Nations and said that New Zealand as a country was discriminating against them. But we did have a finding of that Court of Appeal case, and it's called the Quilter decision.
Named after one of the women involved.
It was.
Yes.
And so essentially that Court of Appeal decision, the majority view was that because the convention of 1955 meant that marriage had only ever been contemplated to be between a man and a woman, irrespective of the fact that our law didn't actually state that same-sex couples could be married, meant that we required legislative change. So they then redirected the decision about whether same-sex couples could marry back to Parliament.
Right. So the courts basically decided on the basis of what Parliament's intention had been.
That's right. And it was more about the convention than the actual wording of the bill, which is why my bill is incredibly simple. All it does is insert a definition and say that marriage is between two people, regardless of their sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity.
Well, the courts weren't quite as brave here as they were in Massachusetts and Canada, you know, where the legislators were given 6 months to get on with it and get the job done.
Yeah, I guess it took us 6 years, not 6 months. And also, we didn't enable same-sex couples to marry. We, in fact, created civil unions.
Well, that's just going to be my next question, because we could have done something about it, but we opted for civil unions instead in 2005. Why was that?
Well, I presume at the time it was seen as something that the electorate would support. And in fact, if you look at the trend over time, so in 2004 when there was a poll, 40% of New Zealanders agreed with marriage equality and 54 were against, whereas one that was taken here 2 months ago, 63% support marriage equality. I think only less than 30 are against, and there's a whole lot that don't mind, don't care. And so I guess the opinion of today is that people are very supportive of marriage equality, and we saw that in the vote actually at the first reading.
I do recall at the time there was a lot of anxiety about the use of the word marriage, and people in Parliament were talking about the sanctity of marriage, using holiness words in a secular Parliament, which is rather strange.
Well, it is, and I think if we look at the evolution of the whole concept of marriage equality, in fact, in 1998, if New Zealand had legislated for marriage equality, we would have been the first in the world, just as we were for enabling a woman the right to vote in 1893.
Right.
And so I guess we weren't at a point in our society where we thought that that was an acceptable thing to do. So we did create civil union. And the most important thing about civil union, it was created to address same-sex relationships, the formalisation of them, but in fact it doesn't discriminate because we have a Human Rights Act and we have a Bill of Rights Act. And so in the last 7 years we've had 2,156 civil unions, and of those just under 22% are by heterosexual couples. So it actually has become an institution that provides other options and other choices for New Zealand couples.
And that's quite different from the situation, for instance, in the UK, where Peter Tatchell and his friends are fighting now against the situation that prevails there, where gay and lesbian couples can get civil unions but heterosexual people can't, and vice versa with marriage.
That's right, and I think that's an important thing for us to discuss within the context of different times. And the reason our Civil Union Act enabled all New Zealanders access to it was because we do have a Bill of Rights and a Human Rights Act that means we can't discriminate. So we have the Attorney General and we have an analysis and we ensure that our legislation doesn't breach not only our domestic laws but international laws, and we shouldn't be discriminating against anybody to what is a social institution that the state mediates.
So fast forward to now and tell us about Lewisa Wall. Why you? Why was it important to you to promote equality legislation?
Look, I'm really proud to join a Labor team that has four out members of Parliament. So I join Grant Robertson, Charles Chevelle and Marianne Street. I am the chair of Labor's Rainbow Caucus, and it was my prerogative to lead our marriage equality commitment. So we were very clear before we went into the last general election that both marriage and adoption equality were things that we would push. And so I put a bill in the ballot, and in its second ballot it was picked. So it was pretty much up to the rainbow gods, I like to say.
For our international listeners, we've got this members' bill as opposed to government legislation, and it's literally a lottery. Tell us how it goes.
It is literally a lottery, and it's also the only opportunity that as an opposition and a member of parliament that we have to make legislative change. And so every member of parliament is allowed one bill in a ballot at any one time. And so my bill was one of 62 bills that were put in the ballot, and it got picked at the second ballot. And I just think in terms of timing, it's perfect because of the international conversations that are happening. It did build on, I guess, Barack Obama's positioning of marriage equality in terms of the presidential election. He's gone through a process and come to a point where he supports it. And it did provide a bit of a catalyst in New Zealand for finding out what our Prime Minister's position on it was, the leader of my party, David Shearer, his position on it. And in fact, it was because of that motivation, I guess inertia, that me then putting my bill in the ballot and it being picked has enabled New Zealand to be part of what is a global conversation around marriage equality.
So really, really lucky in terms of timing. Tell us what it's like for an individual politician, trying to garner support for other MPs for your own piece of legislation, especially one like this, which is so contentious. What was that like?
I'm fortunate because I belong to a party that is committed to marriage equality. But in saying that, we are a broad church within Labor. And so for us, it was a conscience vote. We have 34 members of parliament and 30 of my colleagues, well, 29 actually, in addition to myself, support marriage equality. We have a Green Party in New Zealand who is completely committed to marriage equality. equality. It was in their manifesto. So the 14 Green members of parliament have voted for my bill. We have a Māori party in New Zealand. They have three MPs. Their leadership is incredibly committed to this as well, because from their perspective, families define themselves. We have Mana and their leader supporting this bill. We have John Banks from the ACT Party supporting it, and we have Peter Dunn from United Future. So in fact, we have a solid coalition right across the House at the moment of 50 MPs. I don't underestimate that base has been incredible for us to build on. And with the Prime Minister being so supportive, in fact, what we found from that vote was of their 59 members of Parliament, 30 supported my bill and 29 were opposed. So we've got the majority in the current government, which is fantastic.
That's very good. We've been talking today with New Zealand MP Louisa Wall, who is guiding a marriage equality bill through the New Zealand Parliament. Next time on This Way Out, how New Zealand's adoption laws will be affected incidentally, what sort of hurdles the bill's opposition may put in its way, and how long before it finally passes into New Zealand law. For This Way Out in Auckland, New Zealand, I'm Ross Stevenson.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Christopher Gall, Jason Proctor, Sherry Lund, Kate Clinton, and Ross Stevenson contributed program material. Thanks also to Pacifica Radio's Davey D and to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by the Ivana Foundation and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation. Thanks also to our active listener supporters. Log on to thiswayout.org for program information, special CD offers, news wrap transcripts, and links to our podcasts, blog, and Facebook fan page. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email TWORadio@AOL.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2SER Sydney, New South Wales, Grateful Dread Radio, Baltimore, Maryland, KALW San Francisco, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. That's all. Stay tuned.
Ode on a Grecian Urn by John Keats. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by David Fetterman. Ode on a Grecian Urn by John Keats. Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, sylvan historian, who canst thus express a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme, what leaf-fringed legend haunts about thy shape, of deities or mortals or of both, in Tempe or the dales of Arcady? What men or gods are these? What maidens loathe? What mad pursuit? What struggle to escape? What pipes and timbrels? What wild ecstasy? Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on, not to the sensual ear, but more endeared, pipe to the spirit ditties of no tone. Fair youth beneath the trees, thou canst not leave thy song, nor ever canst those trees be bare. Bold lover, never, never canst thou kiss, though winning near to the goal, yet do not grieve. She cannot fade, though thou hast not thy bliss, forever wilt thou love, and she be fair. Ah, happy, happy boughs, that cannot shed your leaves, nor ever bid the spring adieu. And happy melodist, unwearied, forever piping songs, forever new. More happy love, more happy, happy love, forever warm and still to be enjoyed, forever panting and forever young, all breathing human passion far above, that leaves a heart high sorrowful and cloyed, a burning forehead and a parching tongue. Who are these coming to the sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest, lead'st thou that heifer lowing at the skies, and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town by river or seashore, or mountain built with peaceful citadel, is emptied of this folk, this pious morn. And little town thy streets forevermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return. O Attic shape, fair attitude, with breed of marble men and maidens overwrought, with forest branches and the trodden weed, thou silent form dost tease us out of thought, as doth eternity. Cold pastoral, when old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know. End of Ode on a Grecian Urn. This recording is in the public domain.
Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be interviewing Seneca Elliott about how parents view their teenager sexuality and how that fits with reality. The DNC featured not just female speakers, but hard-hitting policy talk about issues women care about. And Texas claims to be able to replace Planned Parenthood services. But can they? If you haven't seen Minnesota Vikings punter Chris Cluey's defense of gay marriage, written to Delegate Emmett Burns of Maryland, you should go check it out. Burns said that the NFL should prevent athletes from openly supporting gay marriage, and Cluey took offense to that, writing,
Cluey wondered what Mr. Burns was so afraid of. How does gay marriage in any way, shape, or form affect your life? Question mark. I can assure you that gay people getting married will have zero effect on your life. That wouldn't come into your house and steal your children.
The Ed Show didn't even read the funniest part because it was naughty, where Cluey says gay marriage isn't going to turn anyone into his, quote, a lustful cock monster. Frankly, the notion that marriage is turning any kind of lust on anywhere is one that I'll never understand. Well, the Democratic National Convention happened, and the Democrats made a big point out of appealing to female voters through a combination of touching on issues female voters tend to care about more and approaching female voters as if they're just as smart and capable as men. Contrast this with the RNC, which took a softer, more emotional approach, which was explicitly seen as outreach to women on the grounds that we have to be spoken through our hearts and not our heads. To be fair, this wasn't an approach totally rooted in sexism. A large part of it is that Republican policies don't poll well with female voters, and so highlighting policy is likely to backfire. The Democrats, on the other hand, support some kind of social safety net, which tends to draw female voters, though a more robust one would be even better. They are also pro-choice and support the Equal Rights Amendment, which makes highlighting policy a win for them. First Lady Michelle Obama's speech was much heavier on policy than Ann Romney's for this reason, but the reaction to her was the usual sexist minimizing.
Mrs. Obama is no longer seen as the angry spouse and campaigner that many took her to be in the 2008 campaign.
That's from a Fox News report. Don't you just love the way they throw it out there that she was seen as? The truth is that Fox and other right-wing media painted her that way for no other apparent reason than her race and the fact that she's a very accomplished professional. That she overcame that narrative with the sheer force of her personality is kind of amazing. Her speech at the DNC was the result of that makeover. She felt free to speak on all sorts of real issues, and basically no one accused her of being angry afterwards. Even Limbaugh had to admit that Obama is a charming woman, though in order to do so, he had to bash her biggest fans.
Folks, I don't know about you. Let me share something with you. Michelle Obama last night went on and on and on about how she loves her husband. She loves him more now than ever. She loved him more now than yesterday than when she met him 4 years ago and all that. I wonder, how did that play with the feminazis? That's not in the playbook. Loving your husband is not Well, it's not. And look, you get mad at me all you want, but the whole, it was a big disconnect. All that's just going to make people envious.
At this point, Limbaugh, who has been married four times, is just projecting. Plus, Obama is one of those so-called feminazis. She openly advocated for abortion rights in her speech. I'm afraid we have to chalk this one up to the ongoing thing where misogynists project their own hatred of women onto feminists, claiming that we hate men. And we show our hatred of men by advocating for a world where we can, for instance, have sex with them without having more children than they or we want. Besides Michelle Obama, the other big lady speaker who got tons of attention was, of course, Sandra Fluck, who has driven the right completely mad by not apologizing for being a perfectly ordinary 31-year-old law student. Conservatives took to claiming she has no right to be on stage, but Fluck proved that she can tell the difference between simply putting a woman on stage and speaking to a woman's concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I thought what you were saying initially was so telling, that the idea that how to appeal to women is to serve them cocktails and just put women at the podium. It takes more than that. Women want to hear what a presidential candidate is concerned about in terms of women's lives. So women's access to health care and to equal pay for equal work and you know, violence against women. And that kind of substance is what women are worthy of, and that's what we want.
Indeed, there were only really two points in Fluck's speech at the DNC. She talked about how terrible it is to marginalize and silence women's voices, doubly so in debates about women's access to health care. And she talked about the war on women, which is being conducted primarily through policy.
It would be an America in which you have a new vice president who co-sponsored a bill that would allow pregnant women to die preventable deaths in our emergency rooms. An America in which states humiliate women by forcing us to endure invasive ultrasounds that we don't want, and our doctors say that we don't need. An America in which access to birth control is controlled by people who will never use it.
It's worth pointing out that the moral high ground on contraception was achieved by pro-choicers because we stopped playing defense and instead went on the offense. By passing a regulation that requires insurance companies to cover contraception with no copay, pro-choice forces not only improved healthcare access for women, but we also created a situation where our opponents exposed themselves as hostile not just to abortion, but to contraception and sex generally. We should do this more often. I'd like to welcome Seneca Elliott to the program. Seneca is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at North Carolina State University. She's also the author of the new book, Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers, an examination of how parents understand the sex lives of their teenagers. Welcome to RealityCast, Seneca.
Hi, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basic premise of the book. You found that there's a pretty sizable discrepancy between the actual sexual choices teenagers are making in the real world and what their parents believe about their own kids' sexual choices. What's going on with that? Are parents in denial?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. What I found is that the parents I spoke to, and I interviewed a large and diverse group of parents who have teenage children, both sons and daughters, and these parents typically described their own teen children as not interested in sex, as kind of young for their age, maybe a little immature, sexually naive, and not involved in sexuality. On this other side of the coin, they talked about teenagers in general, the stereotypical teen, as highly sexed, as hypersexual, you might say. So they saw their teens as the exception to this sort of larger understanding of teens. And, you know, parents are making these distinctions for a variety of reasons. One of them is, of course, that they're seeing their own teens at times when their guards are down and they're not fronting or, you know, trying to act a certain way in a public setting. But I think also the sort of stereotype that parents have about the typical teen is, you know, stereotypes never really describe reality. They're always distorted. And so, of course, the parents look at their teens and they go, well, that doesn't seem to be my teen. So my teen's not like these other teens.
So basically it's like the same problem as everybody seems to think your typical person claims that they're a better driver than average.
Ah, interesting. Well, right. There is some research that suggests that we tend to see ourselves and those we hold close and dear to us in a more favorable light than we see others. And there are some good psychological reasons for this. It makes sense that you see those people who are close to you as good people. So my argument is not that parents are in denial, but it's the way we're talking about teens and sexual activity that might encourage these ways of thinking. So if we only talk about teen sexuality in terms of risk, pregnancy, disease, or in terms of deviance, or promiscuity, hypersexuality, then of course when parents look at their kids, they're not thinking about their kids in those ways. So my bigger point is that we need to be thinking about how we're talking about teens as sexual beings in our culture. And I don't think we typically talk about them in very positive or favorable ways.
So, in other words, you're saying that because we have this belief that teenagers who have sex are bad kids and delinquent kids, parents are looking at their own kids and not seeing bad kids or delinquents, and so they're concluding that their kids can't be sexual.
Right. They're seeing good kids, and they also don't want to see their kids at risk. I mean, parents care a lot about their kids. The parents I spoke to want good things for their kids, and they don't want to think that their kids might be at risk or might be endangering some of those positive things they hope for their futures by being sexually active. And I should say, even though I didn't interview teenagers, I really do think that teenagers should actively conspire in this idea of their parents have of them as not very sexual. A lot of the parents I spoke with said that their teenagers, you know, would say things when they would bring up the subject of sex, like, "Mom, we don't need to go there. I don't want to hear this. I don't need to know this. I'm not doing any of that." And so would sort of actively present themselves in ways that kind of affirmed that sense that the parents had that they weren't sexual. But they also told me that their teens would often tell them stories about their peers. So, well, you should hear what the kids at school are doing. Or, you know, the kids at school got caught having sex in the bathroom. Or there are four girls in my class this semester who are pregnant. So they're hearing these stories from their teenagers that I think affirm this picture and kind of stoke their anxieties.
Yeah, I remember being a teenager and hearing those stories, and half of them were not true in the first place. So do you think that the parents are aware of that, or do you think that they're just afraid?
The parents I spoke with didn't suggest that they were aware of it. They were afraid. And there, a little context for my interviews. I did interview parents in a state that is it's called a red state. It's traditionally voted Republican. It had a very strong abstinence until marriage effort in the schools. And so this this discourse of abstinence is best, that teenage sex is always and inevitably dangerous, negative, and can ruin a young person's life, was very prevalent in this state. It also happens to be a state with a very high teen pregnancy rate, one of the highest in the nation. So that's the larger context. So these parents were afraid.
So the kids are having more sex than the parents think they are, or like their own kids are. Is that really a problem? Is there danger that stems from parents underestimating how much sex their kids are having?
Well, I don't even know if the kids are having more sex than their parents think they are. That's not really my argument. I think the problem is the fact that people are tiptoeing around sex. And I think ideally parents would be able to see their teens as sexual beings. And when I say that, I don't mean to see them as sexually active, because I think that there's more about sexuality than just the single act of intercourse, which is what we mostly focus on. You know, when we talk about sex, we talk about pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections, and a lot of these things we are linked to sexual intercourse. But my sort of larger argument is that if we only think about teens and sex negatively, then parents have a harder time thinking about their teens as sexual beings. And truly, we're all sexual beings. We all have bodies. We all have desires. We all have curiosities, and those can be affirmed. So thinking even broader beyond these larger debates that have captivated us, and thinking about what it means to be in a body, to be of a body, to be intimate, to know yourself.
So one of the things I thought was interesting about your book is that you definitely frame this particular issue of the perception of teenage sexuality versus sort of the statistical realities as an American cultural phenomenon, because this notion that this sort of discourse around teen sexuality that always frames it as this bad thing or this negative thing is very specific to America. Do you see other countries that are doing a better job of this?
Well, certainly there are other countries doing a different job, and part of it is cultural. I talk in my book about the Netherlands, because this is an interesting contrast to the U.S. Case. In the Netherlands, there's been an active and concerted effort over the past 20 or 30 years to normalize teen sexuality, to try to make it a normal thing that isn't shameful, that isn't hidden away. And at the same time, there have been things done structurally to support that. So, for example, making contraception free and widely available, encouraging teens' sexual health and well-being in a variety of different venues. But Dutch parents in the Netherlands, are quite comfortable with, for example, their teenage children having a partner that they are currently dating, a boyfriend or a girlfriend, spend the night in the bedroom. And what's interesting about that is that really challenges, I think, a lot of American parents' ideas about what's acceptable. But it also means that those Dutch parents are right there and can control their teens' sexuality in many ways. Like, they can say, well, are you serious with this boy or this girl? Is this a relationship that you feel is you're prepared to take to this step? So it's out in the open. They can even knock on the bedroom door and say, do you have everything you need? Is there anything that you might not have that would be important to you to enjoy your evening safely? And so this is a vast difference, right, from the way we conduct ourselves sexually here, where teens and parents both, I think that sex is supposed to be furtive, that it can't be out in the open. Their teens, I think, are wanting their parents to think they're not doing that, and so they're not letting their parents in on their sex lives in whatever shape or form that may take. And parents, I think, feel relieved that they don't have to worry about their teens being involved in that dangerous sexual enterprise. But certainly that isn't probably accurately describing reality. And so I think it probably does a disservice to have sexuality be hidden and furtive and shameful. A lot of parents that I talked to said it was really difficult to have conversations with their teens about sex. They even struggled in the interview. I had parents who really avoided using the word sex. They used it, having it. They avoided using terms like penis or vagina. I heard a lot of euphemisms. And a lot of parents stumbled over particular terms and would turn red or start speaking faster. And these are all signs that they're feeling some shame. And I think there's a long history of shame being attached to people who bring sex into the public realm in our culture. But at the same time, what I find so interesting about the media reaction to my book is that we seem to have this real expectation that parents should be talking with their children. But I think that that's harsh on parents because it's ignoring the sort of larger culture and context in which parents are trying to have these conversations. That makes it harder for parents to do it. And in my book, I actually talk about a couple of parents who did have open and frank conversations with their kids about sex and did think it was important for their young people, not just teenagers, but as young as elementary school, to be equipped with information about their bodies. But some of them were reported to Child Protective Services because other adults thought that their kids knew too much about sex and that perhaps were being abused because of that. So again, I really draw it away from parents and really think about the larger culture of sexual fear that's surrounding parents and children when they might be having these conversations.
My guest today has been Seneca Elliott. Her book is called Not My Kid, What Parents Believe About the Sex Lives of Their Teenagers, and it's available online as well as at local bookstores. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Seneca.
Thank you.
There is pretty much never an assault on reproductive health care access without there being a big lie to cover up the real agenda. And that is, of course, what happens when it comes to everything from abortion restrictions to red states cutting funding to Planned Parenthood. The claim is that this is about abortion, even though none of the funds being cut provide for abortion. But anti-choicers claim that getting your pills at a place that may perform abortions, or, even if they don't, are openly for abortion rights, somehow taints your contraception. It makes, like, it totally the same thing as abortion. But they totally pinky swear that they're not defunding contraception in order to, you know, defund contraception.
In a time when legislative budget cuts have forced dozens of family planning clinics to close, the state says women Planned Parenthood now serves could still find another provider. But there is concern there are not enough clinics to go around, and doctors might not even be willing to take on this huge influx of low-income patients.
Andrea Grimes decided to test this claim as a resident of Austin, a busy metropolitan area that has lots more access to health care than, say, the sprawling suburbs and rural communities that make up so much of Texas. Is it really doable for women who rely on Planned Parenthood to go somewhere else? She looked at Texas Health Service's website to find out all these non-Planned Parenthood providers that were considered accessible to her zip code, and at first it seemed promising.
Search returned 181 results. Does that mean it returned 181 gynecologists ready to see Medicaid patients? Not at all. It returned results like the Austin Endoscopy Center.
Do you realize you're calling the Austin Endoscopy Center?
Oh, I got. You guys are listed on one on their list of Medicaid women's health providers, so this is incorrect.
Okay, so you're wanting to schedule a screening colonoscopy?
No, I'm trying to get a well woman exam.
Okay.
Obviously, I called the wrong place.
We're an endoscopy center.
Okay.
If you want a colonoscopy, call us back.
Sure.
So Andrea kept at it, trying to find these mythical alternative providers to Planned Parenthood, which has a large clinic in the area that's been able to handle a high level of traffic. The results were disheartening.
Nearly 6 hours of those kinds of conversations later, I found 13 clinics or doctors that take the Medicaid Women's Health Program. 13, not 181. Why? because 92 of the state's listings are duplicates. Others are radiology associates and labs and pediatricians and even closed clinics. Others just plain don't take Medicaid at all.
I'm skeptical that those 13 can really handle the offloading. And really, it's not 13, since some of them were physically inaccessible unless you own a car and have all day. And it's not like everyone has a computer and can make these searches. What's nice about Planned Parenthood is that they're easy to remember and in the phone book. It's worth remembering that even if these clinics take Medicaid, that doesn't mean that they distribute contraception on site, which Planned Parenthood does, which means that poor women who already have transportation issues are being asked to dramatically increase the amount of time they devote to getting contraception, time that they usually don't have. And that's all in an urban area with lots of clinics. Many parts of Texas don't even have that. Plus, even if the clinics were there, the money isn't.
And the biggest question, where is Texas going to get all of this funding so it can go out on its own when it doesn't have those federal funds? Well, that question is up for debate, and if possible, we could have an answer out of this hearing sometime today, but they do have a little bit of time to reconsider all of this program, as the rule does not go into effect until November.
For all the hand-waving, I'm going to say that I doubt that they actually intend to make all the money up. This was all an elaborate scheme to cut women off from access to reproductive health care, especially STI treatment and contraception. Because, to repeat a constant refrain, this was never about life, but about punishing female sexuality, and particularly punishing poor women for being sexually active. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts. Pat Robertson really likes the idea of hitting women edition. A man wrote in accusing his wife of disrespecting his authority, including lifting her hand to hit him, though she didn't actually hit him.
Well, you could become a Muslim, then you could beat her.
But in lieu of that.
You don't want to go to Saudi Arabia?
No, no.
You know, I think this man's got to stand up to her, and he can't let her get away with this stuff. And, you know, I don't know. I don't think we condone wife beating these days, but something's got to be done to make
not
her.
Physically, but I mean, why would she not want to talk through their problems? That's
well,
so unlikely.
She is just totally. She's rebellious. The chances are she was rebellious with her father and mother. She's a rebellious child, and she doesn't want to submit to any authority.
Robertson is openly saying that women who don't submit deserve to be beaten. And this seems to be his stance even if there wasn't evidence that the wife raised her hand to her husband ever. His open longing to be able to say it directly, that women who talk back should get smacked down, couldn't be more obvious. Also, the little slam on Muslims, when of course spousal abuse is a problem across religions and cultures.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.
Well, this came in at the last minute. The Great Plains, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State in, it's in Kansas, I guess. It's the Reverend Barry Lynn, Executive Director of the Americans for Separation of Church and State, is speaking at Wichita this coming Friday, September 21st, 7 to 8:30 p.m. Again, that's this Friday, September 21st, 7 to 8:30 p.m. He'll be at the College Hill United Methodist Church, located at 2930 East 1st Street. Again, that's 2930 East 1st Street North, Wichita, Kansas. College Hill United Methodist Church. Look it up on Google. You'll find it. For more information, go to www.greatplainsau.org. It's the annual meeting of the Great Plains AU chapter, and they're featuring as a keynote speaker, Reverend Barry Lynn. A little background for people in Kansas who don't know. Since 1992, Lynn has served as Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He is a member of the Wichita, D.C. U.S. Supreme Court, bar, Lynn earned his law degree from Georgetown University. In addition, he received his theology degree from Boston University School of Theology. Reverend Lynn will speak on a new definition of religious freedom, the fraud of fundamentalism. So that's something, certainly not something you want to miss. And thank you to Frank. Thank you to Frank Smith out of Bluff City, Kansas, who passed this along through the ever-important Kansas Progressive Caucus thread. They're on Facebook, Great Plains AU on Facebook. Check it out again this Friday evening at 7 to 8:30 p.m., September 21st, at the College Hill United Methodist Church, address 2930 East 1st Street North in Wichita. Reverend Barry Lynn, what an honor to have him in our state. Now back to more news from Free Speech Radio News. Right. Hold on here, I'm going to find it. Right now.
With 200 contributing reporters on six continents, Free Speech Radio News brings you the news from many corners of the world.
Екатерина Данилова, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Khalid Silmohand, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Madonna Virola, FSRN, Calapan City, Philippines.
While many newsrooms have closed their bureaus overseas, FSRN's network of reporters living in the communities they cover enables us to bring you international coverage each and every weekday. International grassroots reporting that is indispensable and irreplaceable. Support FSRN and our global coverage by visiting our website, fsrn.org. This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 18th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, comments from presidential candidate Mitt Romney made at a Florida fundraiser draw criticism for his economic and foreign policies. Activists gather in New York to call for an end to solitary confinement and mass incarceration. And we'll go to Syria, where fighting and violence sends residents fleeing across the country, putting strain on local communities. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen confirmed today that the U.S.-led international force in Afghanistan will scale back on-the-ground partner patrols with local forces. Some say such partnerships have reduced the number of civilian casualties in Afghanistan. The move was originally revealed Sunday and attributed to a recent uptick of attacks against NATO forces by Afghan security, known as green-on-blue attacks. Rasmussen said today that the change in strategy will not affect the end date for troop withdrawal.
The overall strategy, it remains the same, that we will continue to hand over in a gradual process lead responsibility for the security to the Afghan security forces, and that process will be completed by the end of 2014, and our ISAF combat mission will end by the end of 2014. Nothing has changed.
Officials also hope the move will minimize risk to foreign forces as protests against a film that ridicules Islam and the Prophet Muhammad continue across the region and around the world. In Bangkok today, hundreds protested outside the U.S. Embassy, which closed hours before, and Indian-administered Kashmir came to a standstill before protests turned violent in the summer capital, Srinagar. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
The shutdown against the anti-Islam film evoked a near-total response in most parts of the Muslim-dominated Kashmir Valley. Shops and businesses were shut and transport was off the roads. Protesters gathered at many places in the capital Srinagar and in other towns as well. They chanted anti-US and anti-Israel slogans and burned U.S. flags and effigies of Barack Obama. A protest march turned violent near the central city when protesters set fire to a government vehicle parked outside the residence of Deputy Chief Minister Tara Chand. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd, who hurled stones in return. Protests against the film have been held in the region since Friday. Calling the film a conspiracy of the West, they want punishment for the filmmaker. A police spokesperson said that except for the vehicle burning incident, most protests around the region today remained peaceful. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
This evening in Fullerton, California, the city's acting police chief is expected to tell the city council that Kelly Thomas, a mentally disabled homeless man, did absolutely nothing to provoke the police beating that led to his death. Lena Nozizwe has more.
On July 5th of last year, officers responded to a call that someone was vandalizing cars. Police questioned Thomas and later reported that he resisted arrest, but surveillance video shows nothing of the kind. Rather, it reveals an unprovoked, brutal beating by six police officers, at the end which Thomas is crying out for his daddy. He died 5 days later. Fullerton Mayor Pro Tem Bruce Whitaker says tonight's statement is almost unprecedented.
It could certainly have gravity in the case, in both the criminal case and the civil case that Mr. Thomas has brought against the city, because it could be considered an admission that the officers weren't acting within full scope of their authority.
So far, two officers have been charged in the killing. One is still under investigation, and three city council members have been recalled. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Thousands of platinum miners in South Africa will go back to work on Thursday after agreeing to a 22% pay raise. The strike at the UK-based Lonmin mine outside of Johannesburg lasted 5 weeks. 34 strikers died when police tried to squelch the protest. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court sent the state's voter ID law back to a lower court today. The state's high court ordered another look at the availability of alternate ID cards to make sure that voters have free and easy access to non-driver's license identification. But State Department of Transportation officials readily admit they still require rigorous documentation. Today's ruling doesn't overturn the voter ID law, but does order the lower courts to suspend the law if voters don't have liberal access to ID or if disenfranchisement will occur. And Chicago teachers are still on the picket line today. Union officials are meeting this afternoon to review a proposed contract and consider calling off the strike. If they don't, tomorrow morning, a judge will hear Mayor Rahm Emanuel's request to order them back to work. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In a leaked video of a private fundraiser, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney told a crowd of wealthy donors in Florida that his campaign would never win over certain Obama supporters, especially those with low incomes.
There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what.
Romney added that it isn't his job to worry about those people. The May fundraiser was held in the Boca Raton home of private equity manager Mark Leader. The admission cost $50,000 per plate. When footage of the event began appearing on the YouTube account Romney Exposed last month, the grandson of former President Jimmy Carter contacted the anonymous source and put him or her in touch with the nonprofit news organization Mother Jones, who began publishing the video segments this week. More clips published today show Romney explaining his thoughts on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and include remarks some peace advocates call damaging. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Though he's publicly supported a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, Mitt Romney told more than 100 major donors in a private Florida mansion this spring that a pathway to peace in the Middle East is almost unthinkable.
These are problems. They're very hard to solve. And I look at the Palestinians not wanting to see peace anyway, for political purposes, committed to the destruction and elimination of Israel. thorny issues, and I say, there's just no way.
Romney went on to lay out his proposed solution to the ongoing conflict.
And so what you do is, he said, you move things along the best way you can, you hope for some degree of stability, but you recognize this is going to remain an unsolved problem. I mean, we live with that in China and Taiwan. All right, we have a potentially volatile situation, but we sort of live with it. And we kick the ball down the field and hope that ultimately somehow something will happen and resolve it.
After the video was widely distributed Tuesday, many human rights groups and political analysts criticized Romney for characterizing all Palestinians as anti-Israel and anti-peace, and for refusing to take action. One of them was Yusuf Munayer with the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., who called Romney's statements troubling and misinformed.
He essentially says there's nothing we can do about this situation. The thing is, most U.S. presidents arrive at that conclusion after at least making some sort of attempt. Presidents in recent history have all been engaged at one level or another in peacemaking efforts. And we can have a long conversation about how effective those were and what the mistakes were that were involved. But they've all at least attempted.
Munayer says while President Obama has not made such disparaging remarks about the Palestinian people, he has not helped the peace process either. Said the Obama administration's unconditional support for Israel, including military aid and diplomatic support in United Nations disputes, undermines its role of impartial mediator.
If you look at what the Obama administration has actually done, it has been very clearly pro-Israel. And so while we're talking about an independent Palestinian state that's viable and contiguous in the West Bank out of one side of our mouth, on the other side, we are acting for the exact opposite. And so that is a central problem that needs to be rectified if U.S. Mediation of this conflict is ever going to be taken seriously by all the players involved.
Though Romney's fundraiser remarks on Palestine do break from his statements in interviews with Haaretz and other newspapers, they are in line with many of his foreign policy advisors and major pro-Israel donors, something he noted in his speech.
I have a very good team of extraordinarily experienced, highly successful consultants. They do races all over the world, in Armenia, in Africa, in Israel. They work for Bibi Netanyahu and his race, and so they do these races and they see which ads work and which processes work best. And we have ideas about what we do over the course of the campaign. I tell them to you, but I have the future.
Romney's team of foreign policy advisors includes former Blackwater executive Kofor Black, former Dick Cheney advisor Eric Edelman, and several members of neoconservative groups like the Heritage Foundation and the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Romney has also received tens of millions of dollars from pro-Israel casino mogul Sheldon Adelson. As criticism over the leaked video mounts, Romney called a last-minute press conference late Monday evening. Though he admitted the answers to donors' questions weren't elegantly stated, he defended the basic premise of what was said. Alice Olsen, FSRN, Washington.
National League for Democracy Chair Aung San Suu Kyi is in the United States for the first time in more than two decades as part of her 17-day-long trip. She's scheduled to meet with congressional leaders and activist groups. Speaking in Washington, D.C. today, the opposition leader from Myanmar, also known as Burma, said the government in her country has made steps toward democratic reform, but more still needs to be done.
Burma had certainly started out on the process of democratization. But how far will it go? How sustainable is it? How genuine is it? Those are the questions.
Suu Kyi won a popular election in 1990 but was denied office by a military junta and put under house arrest for two decades. After being released in 2010, she was elected to parliament. She credited Myanmar's president, Thein Sein, with allowing some changes, such as a release of a limited number of political prisoners, and urged the U.S. and other countries to be watchful of the process.
I believe that he is keen on democratic reforms. But how the executive goes about implementing these reforms is what we have to watch.
After decades of isolation and military rule, Myanmar has become one of the poorest countries in the region. Repression of ethnic communities such as the Rohingya is also a major concern. According to the UN, Myanmar has nearly 800,000 people who are refugees or internally displaced, many of whom rely on emergency aid. This summer, the Obama administration lifted a ban on investment in Myanmar, but Aung San Suu Kyi said opening economic markets had to be connected to reforms in civil and government institutions.
New U.S.-Burma bilateral relations, I would like to be founded firmly in the recognition of the need to give equal weight to the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary, and to judge the progress of democratization in Burma by how strong all these institutions are and how well able to work together as a whole to establish democratic practices in our country.
Suu Kyi met with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today. She's scheduled to receive the Congressional Gold Medal Wednesday. Myanmar President Thein Sein is also scheduled to visit the U.S. next week. Today in Syria, residents reported clashes in homes between government forces and opposition fighters and gunfire in Hama. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, government forces struck areas in Aleppo and Idlib province where the bombing destroyed houses and injured civilians. A video posted online today showed residents digging through a destroyed building to uncover the body of a young man who was motionless and beneath chunks of debris. A group of men cover him with a blanket and carry him out into the street. On Tuesday, the UN Human Rights Commission said human rights violations in Syria were increasing in number, pace, and scale. Abuses are also being credited to anti-government fighters. Human Rights Watch documented 12 cases of summary executions of suspected government fighters by groups connected to the opposition. Both groups said civilians continue to be affected the most. Earlier today, we spoke with Ibrahim Zaidan via Skype from Idlib province. He began by describing the daily attacks that come from air assaults in his area.
They come out in the morning between 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. and in the evening before the sunset about 6 o'clock. This is a daily program. All the residents here get used to it. And when the warplanes or helicopters go in the sky or the people see these warplanes in the sky, they know that a massacre will be committed by these warplanes.
Is there any humanitarian organization, any outside aid groups that are providing food or supplies to people who need it in that area?
No, sir. For example, sometimes, but it's very poor, because in Idlib especially and in the southern countryside, as it is the free of military here, there is a lot of people who come from Hama and from the eastern and western countryside, because it is shelled every day, so people fled their villages and towns and came here to this area. The village, which consisted in the past of about 20,000 people, now it has about 40 or 50,000 people. All of them are out of the village and live here because it is safer in these villages.
As you're describing the situation there, people coming in from other areas, a place of 20,000 going to 40 or 50,000, that's doubling or more than doubling. Where do these people go to live? Is there enough shelter for people who are coming into your area?
People share houses, and a lot of people are living in mosques and in a school. All of our schools and mosques are full of families because the houses were full.
That's Ibrahim Zaidan, a resident of Idlib province, speaking to us via Skype from inside Syria. Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues are investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. Opponents of solitary confinement continue their efforts to raise awareness about the harmful effects of the practice, including severe psychological and physical effects to inmates and the high cost for prisons. In advance of a hearing today in Philadelphia on the issue, activists gathered in New York City to hear from some of the most visible activists fighting to end both solitary confinement and mass incarceration. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo has more.
More than 2,500 people crowded into Manhattan's Riverside Church, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke 45 years ago, calling for social equality and an end to white supremacy. Social justice advocates, including Cornel West, Mark Lamont Hill, and Mamia Abu-Jamal, continued that message in their call to end mass incarceration.
The state correctional institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Former death row inmate Abu-Jamal delivered a recorded speech from a Pennsylvania state prison. He described the effect of solitary confinement on fellow prisoners.
I've seen men driven mad, as a hatter, by soul-crushing loneliness. Men who have sliced their arms until they look like railroad tracks, or sliced their necks, or burned themselves alive. For solitary is torture, state torture, official torture, government-sanctioned torture.
Although exact figures from solitary confinement are difficult to establish, two studies using census data from 2000 and 2005 estimated about 80,000 prisoners in some type of restricted housing. UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, questions its aggressive use against prisoners like Bradley Manning, a U.S. soldier charged for leaking classified information to WikiLeaks.
He never committed a violent act. He never, you know, did anything to harm anybody, let alone himself. So, you know, to keep him in those conditions for so many months amounts to pain and suffering that's associated with cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment.
After studying the impact on prisoners, Mendez concluded that more than 15 days in solitary confinement is inhumane. But in the U.S., the practice has grown over the last few decades. What was once a temporary measure has become long-term, with some prisoners spending months, years, or even decades in dark, cramped cells with no human interaction for up to 23 hours a day.
Torture, the definition of torture is usually the infliction of pain by a state actor, where the degree of pain is very severe, where the purpose could be for gaining information or interrogation, or for the purpose of producing severe pain and suffering.
Elena Landrissina is a former legal intern at the Prison Rights Project, a nonprofit that enforces the legal right of New York City prisoners. She says the U.S. lacks federal policies to protect inmates.
Some countries have agreed to have independent monitors come in and analyze whether the conditions are conditions that produce torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and the U.S., of course, doesn't.
So in other words, prisons are a conflict of interest in themselves?
Yeah. The New York State prisons employ doctors and mental health professionals who come in and assess whether someone is suffering and like to such a degree that they should be put in observation. And I'm sure that they have good intentions and that they're doing their job to the best of their ability, but they're also reporting to the the officials who run the prison.
While the Office of Mental Health is a separate institution from the Department of Corrections, Landrissina says it's still troubling both tolerate the use of disciplinary solitary confinement. But some states are trying to change that. In California and Colorado, plaintiffs have filed suits against their respective state prisons, arguing solitary confinement violates the Eighth Amendment ban against cruel and unusual punishment. Lawmakers on the state and federal level are also paying more attention. This summer, the U.S. Senate held its first ever hearing on solitary confinement. This week, Pennsylvania's Democratic Policy Committee is holding another hearing. Organizers of the hearing say it's needed to reform state prison policies in Pennsylvania. Abu Jamal says it's going to take more than that.
Build a movement that does not seek reform. Build a movement that seeks revolutionary transformation in the prison-industrial complex.
The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee is currently working on legislation to make it more difficult for prisoners to use solitary confinement. On the state level, Colorado officials decided to shut down part of a prison that contained about 300 solitary confinement beds. According to the ACLU, the move will save the state about $17 million over the next 2 years. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn also announced the closure of the Tam Supermax prison. But the closure is currently held up in the courts, following a lawsuit by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN.
To hear Mumia Abu-Jamal's entire recorded commentary on mass incarceration and solitary confinement, visit FSRN.org. In Canada, the anniversary of the Occupy movement coincided with the opening of Parliament. In the capital, Ottawa, Occupy members joined union leaders and other activists in marching through the streets towards the steps of the nation's legislature, calling for the resignation of Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper. FSRN's Tanya Castle reports.
On the footsteps of Canada's parliaments, about 200 people of all ages and walks of life rally against Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Some wear pins reading, "Stephen Harper hates me," and brandish placards stating, "I am the 99%, stop Harper, and we are all affected," referring to the deep government cuts to social programs across the country. Miranda Dyke, a mother and political analyst, was at the protest with her two young children. She was there to show her solidarity with the 99% in Canada and around the world.
For me, it's about being part of the global movement. It's a ministry. It's about being a part of the worldwide movement of the 99%, just standing up and saying that, you know, the 1% doesn't deserve to have it all, that there are people who are starving, there are people who are really struggling, and we're starting to see a lot more of that in Canada under Harper's government.
Activists say under Harper's reign, economic inequality is rising, and so are affronts to human rights, democracy, women's rights, indigenous rights, and the environment. Since Harper took office in 2006, he shut down the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development, a government-funded watchdog agency, and the Court Challenges Program, which provided funds to support test cases against discriminatory laws. He's also slashed funding for the Canadian Human Rights Commission and for Status of Women Canada, resulting in office closures across the country for both.
Now there's a group of walkers who've been walking here since May Day, May 1st. A group of about 10 people.
Protest MC Lana Goldberg, a member of Occupy Toronto and political science student at York University, adds to the long list of Harper's assaults on Canadian values and people.
This last omnibus budget bill killed environmental regulation, research, and monitoring. This regime has been approving pipelines and other mining projects with complete disregard for Indigenous communities. I mean, it's just atrocious what's happening right now, and I felt like we needed to make a stand, let this regime know that we are paying attention and we're not going to stand for it.
Currently, the Northern Gateway oil pipeline, if approved, would carry tar sands oil from Alberta through British Columbia's wilderness to the Pacific coast. According to recent polls, it is opposed by more than half of British Columbia's residents, and more than 100 Indigenous groups have filed legal action against it as it passes through their land. Harper's environmental record is one of the reasons Adam McLaren, a freelance videographer, is attending the protest. He says he wants to find out more. He wants to know how Harper is getting away with these policies.
The majority of the issues that I have are the environmental issues, like pipeline straight to, through BC and everything like that. Those are the things that I feel really strongly about, that I feel are incredibly wrong and dangerous, and the fact that the majority of people don't want it, and yet it's still like trying to be pushed through, it's mind-boggling to me.
Participants in Tuesday's rally emphasized their concerns about the widening gap between the rich and the poor in Canada and the erosion of equality. 73-year-old artist Linda Luneau, like Mother Miranda Dyke, was one of them. She says Canada is just not the place it used to be.
Right now I just feel this is a Canada that I'm not proud of at all. And even though there were many errors made in other governments, and maybe I didn't agree with a lot of policy, there was still a social concern that we just are not seeing now. And equality is disappearing.
I ain't gonna study.
Anniversary Occupy protests were also held in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, and other cities across Canada. All called on the removal of Harper. The next protest will be October 15th. Tanya Castle, FSRN, Ottawa, Canada.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
We got no plans, no plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight her like sheep, swallow everything. Always simpletons or pretending. We got no plans.
This is your moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. I assume most of you have noticed that our culture seems to be downright obsessed, infatuated, and fixated on zombies and vampires. They seem to be in every movie, TV show, novel, video game, and breakfast cereal that permeates our mental activities. Why is that? Well, I think it's because we're surrounded by them in reality, in our everyday lives, and we don't realize it. Think about it. People walking out into traffic because they've got their iPod in their ears and their iPhone in their hands. They are zombies, unaware of their surroundings, merely seeking the next small dopamine burst from achieving the next level in a video game. Customer service employees with no genuine emotion, just following the franchise guidelines for human interaction in order to suck money out of you. Dead eyes, plastic smiles, every cashier is a Joan Rivers-faced version of a human being. Soulless, empty companies that mean nothing and don't even seem to produce anything, yet rake in billions like Goldman Sachs. Twitter accounts that automatically pump out tweets not actually from any celebrity. You get Facebook friend requests from fucking bags of potato chips now. You're tagged in photos of shoes as if you are those shoes. Was it a human who posted that photo? A shoe zombie? A footwear wolf? And now a part of your Facebook soul has been given up to a pair of Nikes forevermore. Charges on your credit card that aren't actually from you. I didn't spend $312 on roach repellent in Poughkeepsie. No, you didn't, but it was a mindless clone pretending to be you. It was the vampire you. Foodstuffs from fast food places that don't really give you any nutrients and instead zap your energy, leaving you tired and mentally vacant. It's vampire food, sucking your life force. Corporate politicians devoid of conscious thought, stumbling along and spitting out whatever robotic line will get them elected. God knows what happens when one of those politicians talks to a customer service representative. Must be like placing Teddy Ruxpin across from a speaking spell. For-profit universities and health services slurping at the bank accounts of the sick and hopeful. And corporations, having been endowed with the freedom of speech and declared human by the Supreme Court, are not only the richest zombies mankind has ever seen, but they are also the most powerful, eating the brains out of our entire political and social system. No wonder we're all so fascinated with vampires and zombies right now. We're fucking surrounded by them. Are you prepared for the zombie apocalypse? I hope so, because you're in it. That's been your moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. Can you think of other zombies and vampires, other walking undead permeating our culture? If so, write them in the comment section or at leecamp.net, and the person with the best one will win a free digital download of my comedy album, Pepper Spray the Tears Away. Thanks. Keep fighting.
Plans, no plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight her like sheep, swallow everything. Always simple tins or pretend.